Today we're exploring Captain of Her Soul, The Life of Marion Davies by Lara Gabrielle, a groundbreaking biography of film star Marion Davies. For decades, Davies' life has been told through the lens of gossip columnists, fan magazines, and her famous connection to the press baron, William Randolph Hearst. But Gabrielle's meticulous research and access to rare archives reveal a very different story. A fiercely independent woman who overcame stigma and disability, negotiated her own career, became one of Hollywood's top comedians, and devoted herself to philanthropy. This book brings Davies out of her shadow and restores her place as a dynamic figure who lived her life on her own terms and proudly declared herself the captain of her soul. I know you enjoy this conversation. Let's go meet Lara and talk about her incredible book. We're going to start with a simple question, which is, what's your favorite Marion Davies performance?
I think that her best performance is in a movie called The Patsy. It's a silent film from 1928. It's often ranked as like in her top three films, but it's often ranked under this other movie called Show People, which probably is a tighter movie. But what I like to say is that Show People is probably the greatest Marion Davies film, and The Patsy is the greatest Marion Davies performance. Like it best exemplifies what she was able to do. Like she was jumping and rolling around and having this great time and just letting loose with all of her comedic tools. And it's just such a joy to watch.
What about her most underrated performance? Which one's overlooked, but you think is an important one for her?
I think 5 and 10 is a really underrated performance. People talk sometimes about Peg of My Heart. I actually prefer 5 and 10 to Peg of My Heart because she gets to perform a range of emotions and a range of really complex feelings. And that's something that she didn't very often get to do in her earlier films when Hearst had more control over what she did on screen. And then when the pre-code era came along, 1929 to 1934, she was much more able to tap into this complexity in her emotional range.
Gotcha. I went back and I've watched a couple movies before reading your book, but they weren't front of mind. So I went back and I watched The Patsy. I watched Little New York. I watched a couple of them. And When I was watching, a friend of mine was in the room and saw some movies I was watching. He was like, how do you watch silent film? Because there is a translation issue for a modern person to go back and watch film. What's the best way to approach silent film for someone that doesn't regularly consume it?
Honestly, I think the best way to get into a silent film is to watch the basics. It's almost like learning a language, starting with like children's books and things. I think that if you're trying to get into silent film or learn how to watch a silent film, start with Buster Keaton shorts, the Chaplin shorts, the foundational texts, we can say, of silent film. And Buster Keaton, people love Buster Keaton. Kids love Buster Keaton. And so if you watch those, you'll get a sense of what the language is.
Because you got to have to be a lot more expressive with your body.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more kinesthetic energy, it seems.
And it is difficult for people who have grown up watching, I don't know, the Marvel movies or something, to jump right into like Little Old New York. It's tough because it's a whole different way of approaching cinema. And so, yeah, getting that foundational knowledge is really critical to being able to watch, silent film, because it's a whole different world. These are people who came from the stage, generally. These are people who knew how to emote. And because the silent screen had no sound, people had to mime. And so it helped. It certainly helped Marion that she had really big eyes, and she was able to use those big eyes to express things. And so a lot of these stage performers really succeeded in silent film because they knew how to emote.
Let's talk about writing about film more generally. It's a really crowded space between film reviews, like boostery, ghost-written things. You have film criticism more broadly. It seems like a complicated space to write in. So can you talk about some of the challenges of writing about the history of film from that kind of vantage point?
Main challenge about writing the history of film, especially the silent era, is the lack of readily available resources at your fingertips. I was lucky in several ways. I was lucky that the Hearst Archives are at UC Berkeley, which is really close to me, that I was able, work-wise and otherwise-wise, to travel, to go to the Library of Congress, to go to the New York Public Library, to go to UCLA and USC and all of these places where papers are and films are. And if I hadn't been able to do that, it would have been a lot more difficult to get to the research place that I got to with the book, because things are all over the place. It's not like you can access papers by going on the internet.
Yeah. And it also seems like there's the mythology of Hollywood and then there's Hollywood. Once you get into it, is it easy to see the illusion versus reality, or is it still foggy when you're in the archives, if you will?
I was able to pretty easily disprove a lot of rumors that have followed Marion Davies for years. Once you're in the archives and you start looking at stuff, in dates and in correspondence, it's okay, that rumor's not true. You see it before your eyes.
Yeah, let's jump into some of the different kinds of source material on Marion Davies' life because I think it's interesting. In prep for this interview, I picked up Hollywood Babylon,
Oh dear.
which was a fascinating, it was fascinating in many respects to read, but that seems like one kind of gossip. Is that like proto People magazine or something like that mixed with like juicy, salacious gossip? Like, how should we look at what I would learn about Marion Davies from a book like that?
So Hollywood Babylon, I would call somewhat akin to The Inquirer.
Okay.
It's very trashy. A lot of the stuff I have no idea where he got. I think he just pulled it right out of thin air. This whole thing about the origin of the name Rosebud, like where did he get that? Like it's like
Is just
what?
making things up, you think? Is that what's going on? Yeah.
I think he's making up stuff that he thinks people will lap up. And if you talk to people who knew Kenneth Anger and who ever had any interactions with him, that's who he was. He was a what do you call those people? A muckraker almost.
Yeah, he seems like a character from a Tarantino movie or some kind of spastic, just wild all over the place, huckster, just looking to make a buck. But what's the picture he painted? Because I know that book was published in her lifetime, and so she must have seen it. And what was the picture? What came from that book?
One thing that I can say about Marion, since you brought it up, is that Marion let a lot of things just roll off right off her back. There were all kinds of things that were hurled at her. She didn't take any of it to heart, didn't let anything affect her. That was a real blessing in her life that she was able to do that as a gift. And especially with like Citizen Kane, the situation with Citizen Kane when the movie came out in 1941, and everybody's, oh, it's about you. Everybody knows it's Hearst's life. This is what her sister said to her. And Marion's reaction was, he can make whatever movie he wants to make. There's nothing that I can or want to do about it. And if it's a good movie, I'd like to see it. If it's not a good movie, I won't see it. That was literally, that's what she said.
Yeah, from your book, the adjective for her that I came away with was blasé. She's just going along and just taking things in stride. And before we get into her, though,
Always.
I want to stay on the books.
Thank you.
Because there's one other main biography that's been published by Giles in 19.
Right.
So if you would set your book in, because I did not read Giles' book, if you set your book and his book side by side, where do you think the biggest points of departure are?
I think that Giles, we could talk in several different ways about this. We could talk about the research side of it. We could talk about
Maybe just your picture of Davies, like
the picture
how
of
did
Marion. Yeah,
yeah.
okay. He approached Marion from a more, how do I say, standoffish way. He was looking at her from a distance, it seemed, critiquing her as though he were like a film critic, I would say, but regarding her life. Mine, it was important to me to get really close to my subject. It's not necessarily better or worse than Giles. It's a different approach, right? So I wanted to get Marion as close to Marion's point of view as I could get. How she saw the world, how she felt about things as much as I could get that, and just her world.
Yeah. And then lastly, what can we take away from her memoir? I know Hearst is in the title, and so I'm at the center of gravity, but what do we learn about her through her writing, through her words?
So the memoir, as you call it, is not really a memoir.
Yeah. In quote, I should have done in quotation marks.
Yes. So the memoir is a posthumous cut and paste of her autobiographical tapes. So these are not Marion's actual words per se. The editors of this book had gotten a hold of Marion's autobiographical tapes. After the Patty Hearst kidnapping, there was a renewed interest in Marion and the memoir. And so they got a hold of the autobiographical tapes. They got permission to do something with them. She had wanted to do an autobiography. It didn't work out. We can talk about that later, but there was a reason why it didn't work out. And these editors thought that it would be interesting to see what Marion Davies' memoir would have looked like if it had come to fruition. So they took her tapes and they cut and pasted different things together. So having heard the actual tapes myself, there are things from tape one that are pasted in with things from tape six and things from tape three that are pasted in for tape four and tape 16. And
Wow.
so it's not her words, it's the editor's words, it's the editor's narrative.
Okay. And what would you describe as the kind of thesis statement of that memoir? Because again, I did not read that as well.
There is no real thesis statement. And again, I want to say about the memoir is that there's a reason that the memoir didn't come to be in her lifetime, because it was not a good time for her to be writing a memoir. She was having trouble with the Hearst Corporation. She was sad after Hearst's death. She was stuck in a bad marriage. She was not willing to say a lot of the things that she needed to say in order for the memoir to be good. So the times we had comes away as being very disjointed because of the nature of the work.
Yeah. Lastly, before we jump into the more specifics of her life, I want to ask you about your research process. I know you conducted a lot of interviews for this. Talk to us a little bit about what it's like trying to capture the life of a celebrity through kind of oral history. I know there's challenges that with that because oftentimes these people are in the news and then you start to confuse the news with memory and so I'm sure there's some challenges there. Can you talk a little bit about your process?
Interviews were, of course, obviously limited to the people who were still alive, who knew Marion, and they are quite few and far between now. I was lucky to get a few people before they died. I talked to Mary Carlisle, who was on the 1936 trip to Europe. That was really fun. I became very close to her great niece, who lives in France. I became very close to a man named Stanley Flink, who helped Marion do her autobiographical tapes and was also the only member of the press there in the house the day of Hearst's death. So I was able to get some really good, important people who were able to help me tell the story that way. But obviously, there were a lot of people that I couldn't talk to. Frances Marion was long gone. Anita Loos is long gone. These important people in her career died long before I ever started thinking about this. So I couldn't talk to them. However, Giles, bless him, conducted interviews with those people and taped them. And I had access to those tapes.
Wow.
So I was able to listen to Giles's interviews with them and one, get sources for some of the assertions that he made in his book. His book doesn't have any endnotes. So I couldn't, by itself, because of my own personal process, I couldn't take anything from Giles's book without getting a second source from it because I couldn't find where he got it. So the tapes really helped me to get that second source so that I could take from Giles. Yeah. And so I had a lot of luck in a lot of ways. The people who I was not able to get, Giles had gotten, and we almost, Giles passed away in 2000. So I wasn't able to talk to him, but it's almost as if we were working together, like across planes. It was very cool.
Let's jump into Marion's life. It seems like she had a somewhat tranquil childhood, but a very traumatic incident with her brother. Can you talk about how that affected her family? And is that, are there tentacles that reach out from that into her life that you see?
Absolutely. I think anybody who has lost a sibling in childhood could tell you that it affects you for your entire life. And she was 2.5 when her brother died, so she was really not very cognizant of the world, except I think, as I wrote in the book, that her brother was gone and her parents were despondent. And having that kind of tragedy in your family at such a young age, I think, really marks you. And she was lucky in the fact that her parents never tried to hide anything about her brother. It's not that they didn't want to talk about him. They talked about him a lot. They had pictures of him around. This was the way that parents dealt with death in the days before World War I. And after World War I, things changed. But it was a very Victorian kind of approach to dealing with death. And so he was always around, but she had trauma from that. Like she, whenever anybody would be close to death or whenever she was informed of a death, she would completely break down and dealt very badly with death.
Yeah, I try not to do too much psychoanalysis when I'm reading stuff.
Well,
And it can't help but see someone whose family was deeply, deeply wounded by this death. And she goes along with a lot of stuff and she wants to entertain others. Like it seems kind of like all of this is interconnected.
and I'm not sure. There were, of course, a lot of things in her life. Besides that, she loved people. I think that was because of her temperament. She was a very much a people person, and she also had this stutter that affected her a lot. And I think that she spent a lot of time kind of compensating for that. Like that may have been part of the, oh, come over, you come to my house, and this sort of over generosity that might have factored into it a little bit. But I think most of it is just her personality. She was just a warm, loving, generous human being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she got into entertainment pretty early on in childhood. And before picking up your book, I hadn't heard of Ziegfeld Follies. I didn't know what this was exactly. Can you explain what it was and then how she got roped into this world?
Sure. Ziegfeld Follies, an entertainment spectacle. That's the best word that I can think to describe it. This entertainment spectacle in New York City, helmed by this man named Florence Ziegfeld, who made it his mission to make this the most beautiful, glamorous show on Broadway. And it was like a variety show. So there would be songs and dances and these women in these glorious clothes. And it paralleled the situation in New York City, where there was lots of immigrants coming in. There was no place to house them. the city was overcrowded and there was a lot of poverty, and so it was miserable for a lot of people in New York City in the early part of the 20th century. But this show gave an antidote to that, and people would come and they would forget their troubles. And it was a real superpower of a show. And it ran, it was like Ziegfeld Follies of 1914, 1915, 1916. And that was the name of the show. And they each had different themes every year. And so Marion was in the Ziegfeld Follies of 1916. And that was a Shakespeare theme. So she played Anne of Cleves. She did all kinds of fun, like dances and things. And that was what she always loved. Not necessarily, although she did love the Ziegfeld Follies, but not necessarily Ziegfeld, but she loved being on the stage. That was her, she felt that was her calling, and that was her true place, was on the stage.
There's also a dark side to Broadway and this world for women. Can you talk a little bit about that?
What do you mean?
Just the sexism that I read about, not necessarily in yours, but when I was researching this particular era, a lot of women were harassed, and there was a lot of challenges with
Oh,
being a young
absolutely.
woman on the stage in the 19 teens on Broadway.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Not a whole lot has changed, to be honest with you. But yes, so there were women who, the most prominent thing, name that I can think of is Barbara Stanwyck, right? Barbara Stanwyck, when she was a Ziegfeld girl and was being on in Broadway with Al Jolson, and Al Jolson put a cigarette out on her chest. Like this, that kind of thing happened a lot. With Marion, Marion didn't really live in that, where she was really young. She befriended the chorus girls. She didn't have, I didn't find any.
So her age gave her some immunity from some of these things.
Yeah, I think
Okay.
so. I think her age and the groups that she gravitated toward. She wasn't trying to be a star. She wasn't trying to sleep her way to the top or anything like that. She was just having fun. Yeah.
How does someone get discovered through these? Because there's a lot of people that got their start on this particular kind of stage. Like, I think today about like agents and things like that, but like, does one get noticed in that time?
Depended. It boiled down a lot to who you knew. Same thing with today, right? It boils down to who you know. And it happened that Marion was the youngest of five, and then when her brother died, it was four girls. So she was the youngest of the four girls, and all of them went into show business. First was her sister Renee, who went to Chicago, was on the stage in Chicago, married this man named George Lederer, and then Ethel, her sister Ethel, went into show business, did the same thing, didn't marry anybody, but was on the stage with these big name stars. And Marion was having trouble in school. Rose, her other sister, was having trouble with her legs and was generally felt like she maybe didn't want to be in school. And Marion's stutter was bothering her. She was being bullied at school. And she told her mom, she said, "I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be in school anymore. I want to go on the stage like my sisters." And her mom resisted for a while, but then Marion just made it clear that she wanted to be a dancer. She wanted to be a dancer. So her mom finally said, "Okay, fine, you can do it." So she and Rose together went to a friend who had known Renee and said, "We want to be on the stage. What can you do for us?" And so that friend helped get them in this little show called The Sunshine Girls, and they were on the stage. And then they got another job, and then got another job. So they got noticed. Rose married young. She married young, and then married again, and married again, and married again. But and so she was not in the business for very long. But Marion kept going and going, and she met Hearst.
Let's talk about that. How, what were the circumstances of their meeting? And I have an image in my head of him sitting like in a dark, like a balcony or something, like watching her and seeing potential.
That's been a rumor that has been that I've managed to say that's not what happened. Yeah, what really happened, there were all these rumors about how they met. One rumor was that keeps repeating is that he was sitting in the theater watching her with one seat for him and one seat for his hat. There's another that he and Marion met at a house party, and Marion was so nervous she vomited on the couch cushion. So that's Anita Loos's story. We take Anita Loos with a big grain of salt. And but what seems to be the actual truth, is that Marion was dating a guy. She was dating a guy named Paul Block, who, if you know the journalism world, he was in advertising. He was at that point in time the art director for the was it the no it was the it was one of the New York magazines. I'll have to review that, but it was a paper in New York. And anyway, so he and Marion were going out, and he, because of his place in the journalism world, he knew Hearst and knew everybody else, and they would all get together at Delmonico's restaurant in New York, and he would bring Marion along. And so Hearst met Marion there just organically as Paul Block's girlfriend. And everybody was very taken with her. She was so charming. She would work the room and she could talk about baseball. She could talk about the stock market. She could talk about all these things, and everybody loved her. But Hearst said, okay, she's very charming, but she's Paul Block's girl, whatever. Paul Block wanted to make a movie with Marion because she had demonstrated, this was early Hollywood, or I should say the early film industry. It wasn't quite Hollywood yet, the early film industry. And there were stars that were on the ascent, like Mary Pickford and Florence Lawrence, and these people who had a certain charm and looked a certain way. And Marion fit that profile of charm and beauty. So Paul Block wanted to essentially try to make her a movie star. And but he didn't have any clout. So he ended up going to Hearst and he said, "Can you help me finance this movie for Marion?" And Hearst, who was now more than dabbling in the film industry, he had his own company, he said no. He didn't want to do that because Marion had not been proven, and she was a risk. She was too much of a risk. So Paul Block said, "Okay, I'll do it myself." So he put up the money himself, hired a bunch of people to write this movie. It was pretty ragtag production, but he got it completed and got it released. And it's Marion's first movie, Runaway Romany. It was not a terribly great movie by all accounts. It's lost, unfortunately, we can't see it. But Hearst was ribbing Paul Block and saying, "Oh, I'm glad I didn't finance it," whatever. And Paul Block said, "Go, just go see it. Just go see the movie. I think you'll enjoy it." So he went and he saw it, and he saw Marion on the screen, and he fell in love with Marion. And essentially went to Paul Block and said, "I want to be formally introduced to her," because they had met, of course, in Delmonico's, but in those days you had to be formally introduced to somebody to be like socially together. So they were formally introduced, and the rest is history.
Yeah, let's talk about their relationship. I've looked at it from a different, obviously from your book, but I've also read some books about Hearst. I watched a documentary about their relationship that I think came out a few years ago. And it seems a bit of an enigma because there's an element of like kind of utilitarian, instrumental, working with each other to get what they want, but they also seem to have like genuine affection for each other. And so it seems complicated. So, like, how do you understand what is going on here? What's the center of their relationship?
To go from what you just said, they had two relationships. They had two separate relationships. They had a relationship
You see
that,
them as separate pathways almost, or parallel tracks.
because you were saying that they were utilitarian, using each other to get what they want. In the studio, absolutely. They were boss and star. They were essentially mogul and star in the studio. At
Okay.
home, it was a totally different dynamic. At home, they were essentially operating as husband and wife. They'd been together. They were together all of Marion's adult life. They knew each other extremely well. They spent all their time together, lived together. Just they were partners.
So you think they were
And
able to compartmentalize those kind of sections?
not even able to compartmentalize, Hearst at least had to compartmentalize.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had this inability to mix his public and private lives. It came to a head later on when there was an attempt at marriage. And anyway, we could talk about that if you want to, but his public and private lives were like oil and water. He would lambast somebody in his papers and then invite them over to dinner the next day. He was real, talk about an enigma. Nobody can figure him out. But yeah, their relationship was, we could t so in terms of the studio, Hearst thought he was in charge. Hearst thought he was in charge. Marion really crafted her own career. People say that, oh, Hearst, she would have been so great as a comedian without Hearst. For one thing, Marion, I don't think, had the drive to be a star that it would have taken for her to get as far as she got without Hearst. He was that driving force. She would have been happy to retire and just be a domestic. And for another thing, I think that Marion did what she wanted in the industry. She was tired of being put in all these costume dramas. She went along with it for a while, but knew that her real strength was in comedy. And so she pulled the chains to work it so that she could be a comedian herself. So that's why my book is titled Captain of Her Soul, because she really did all of this herself.
Yeah. Can you describe for people the Hollywood that Davies arrived in? Gender roles, maybe the sociological complexion of this universe coming from New York and Broadway to this new world where recently I read that a new kind of that Ronald Reagan biography that just came out recently. And it was fascinating to watch the dynamics between Reagan and Nancy, who were both in this. It's a little later, it's 20 years later or so, but there was a lot more flexibility for them than maybe if they were in the Midwest or something. It seems like Hollywood was maybe a bit different than the average American city. Would you describe it that way?
I definitely would say it was, yes, definitely. In fact, I think that in any other city other than maybe New York, Hearst and Marion and their relationship, Hearst not having divorced from his wife, but living with Marion, would have not been accepted at all. In Hollywood, they still tried to keep it down low, but it was everybody knew. Everybody knew and nobody cared, except maybe the hardline Catholics.
There's a permissiveness that was present.
And there was an acceptance of other lifestyles. There was a thriving gay scene in Hollywood at that time. Marion's niece was openly gay. Her co-star and very good friend William Haynes was openly gay. So there was an openness that didn't exist other places. And in some senses is even maybe not accepted in some places today.
I want to talk about. I read a lot of writing, not just in your book, but other places, about this kind of contrast between her serious work and her comedic work. I think we all know that she wasn't at home in more kind of serious, dramatic work in the way that she was in comedy. How did she view those two different genres? And did she feel, because I know Hearst pushed for more serious work, more dramatic work. How did she feel about that?
She knew that she was a comedian, and she was being told that by essentially everybody in Hollywood except Hearst, right? Everybody that she met as a director wanted to do a comedy with her. That was like a dream of all the directors. And some directors managed to get a little bit of comedy in their movies, like in this movie called Getting Mary Married. Alan Dwan was able to do it, and Robert Vignola was able to do it in Night Was in Flower. And then King Vidor finally got the jackpot and was the director of Patsy and Show People.
So was
She
she just appeasing Hearst in attempting these kind of roles, or?
think that she was necessarily appeasing Hearst. I think that she was working. She was a working actress. And these were the jobs that she was given, and she took them and did them. And she was happy to do them. And might not have been exactly what she wanted to do, but it was her job. And this is something that I feel a lot of actresses don't necessarily get credit for, that these are working people doing a job. And that's certainly how she viewed, that's really how she viewed all her career, to be honest with you. She enjoyed it. She was proud of it, but she was also very happy to let it go when it was time.
Got it. How is she viewed in the history of film relative to some of the other stars of this era, your Mary Pickfords, your Gloria Stanwycks. Like, where do you, not to get like in rankings here, but where do you situate her in the hierarchy of a lot of the stars of the silent era in those early years of the talkies?
The hierarchy is tough because everybody's different.
Your hierarchy, where do you situate her?
I'm biased, of course. I mean,
Yeah.
I spent 9 years with the woman, so I feel like I know her really well.
Yeah.
And I know what she was going through at each point in her career. So it's hard for me to compare her to like a Colleen Moore or somebody, like somebody who hasn't had a lot written about them. I haven't spent a lot of time working on Colleen Moore. Yeah, it's my own personal hierarchy. I couldn't tell you. We would have to go with.
Maybe this is a bad question. I was just trying to get you to talk about like where every area has their kind of leading figures, like where she's situated in the kind of like that world of stars.
Again, it depends on who you ask, and it depends on what genre you're looking at. If you're looking at comedians, I would say she's probably the top comedian, female comedian of the silent era, up there with Chaplin and with Keaton. And she is now, thank goodness, regarded that way. For a long time, she was not given her due. She was not given her due as a comedian. But yeah, the closest person that I can think of to Marion doing the kinds of things that Marion was doing and to at the level that Marion was doing is like Mabel Normand on the teens. And there is something kind of Mabel Normandish about Marion, but I think that Marion was more intense about it. She was more deliberate. And one thing that I say in the book is that Marion is the matriarch of this certain type of comedic family, right? So she was doing screwball comedy long before screwball comedy was named. So like in the Patsy, what I was talking about before, in the Patsy, she's doing a lot of the stuff that Carole Lombard was doing later on. And then Lucille Ball was doing stuff that Carole Lombard did. And then Carol Burnett was doing the stuff that Lucille Ball did. And the ball started with Marion. And so I think that's probably the better comparison, like where Marion lands in the world of comedy.
So she created a language that then was
Yes.
adapted by future performers. Okay, that makes sense
Yeah,
to me.
yeah. A
Let's
style.
let's pivot to her philanthropic work, which I did not know about. And why was she so quiet about it?
I think that she didn't want the attention, really. She wanted to do it without it being written about in the papers, and she wanted to do it because she wanted to do it, not because she wanted the attention.
Okay, so there wasn't any sense of signaling that I'm a good person by doing these things. It was just something that she felt a responsibility or duty, or it was just it gave her pleasure, you think?
She
Pleasure, you think?
was a good person. I mean,
Yeah.
that's kind of long and short of it. She just was a good person. She wasn't doing it for the attention. She was doing it for the fact that the children in Los Angeles, the low-income children in Los Angeles, needed a clinic.
Yeah. Can you talk about Children's Hospital? Because that's a major kind of legacy piece of hers.
The Marion Davies Children's Clinic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she started the Marion Davies Children's Clinic in 1926 because she was told by community members that there were these epidemics that were breaking out in this certain section of West Los Angeles. And there was no clinic. Parents couldn't afford to bring their kids to the hospital. It was too expensive and too far away. So Marion saw this need, and she partnered with the community to first create the Marion Davies Foundation, which then built the Marion Davies Children's Clinic, which was a free clinic for low-income children in West Los Angeles, open to anybody, staffed by doctors who volunteered their time from UCLA and from other places. And it was responsible, the people who were treated there, I have some interviews with them, and the people who were treated there said that it really was directly responsible for eradicating like diphtheria and a lot of the sanitary problems that were affecting the children and the families in Los Angeles. And there was a lot of racism in Los Angeles at that time. Like one of the one of the kids who was being treated at the clinic said that his dad had been fired from, or had not been fired, couldn't get a job because the union wouldn't hire a Hispanic man, or the union wouldn't accept a Hispanic man to be part of the union. And he had a bunch of kids to take care of. And the clinic provided this care that they would not have gotten otherwise because the family couldn't afford to eat, much less take their kids to the hospital. Yeah, the neighborhood of West Los Angeles was heavily, at that point, Japanese and Mexican. So a lot of the clinic children were children of these Mexican and Japanese immigrants that had a really hard time finding a job.
It's a fantastic part of her story, and that's where I wanted to close ultimately. I do have some kind of broad, kind of 20,000 foot perspective questions. And the first one's a little abstract. How do you think California, this is a California History Podcast, how do you think California changed Marion? And the flip, how do you think Marion changed California?
Oh boy. I think that California changed Marion, certainly giving her a career that she, the film career that she, that probably would have stagnated if she had stayed in New York. And it provided her with a community that she really enjoyed. She, even though she was born and raised in New York and started her career in New York, she always considered California her home. She felt much more comfortable in California than she did in New York, among the people in California than she did in New York. And how Marion changed California, my goodness, like we've got the,
You could just give a bullet point list if you
I
need
mean,
to. That's it.
yeah,
So many ways.
like we've got the beach house, right? The Edinburgh Beach House. We've got the fact that it was Marion who made the decision to give the Hearst Castle property to the state of California. That was her decision.
Change school, children's school field trips forever.
Yes. And yeah, there's a whole story about that. I wish we had more time because I could talk forever about Marion, how Marion was in charge of. She was at the head of the Hearst Corporation after Hearst's death. It's a whole big long story about that. But she went to Hearst Castle. They hadn't been there in years. They hadn't been there since Hearst died. And this was like probably, it was probably like 6 or 7 years since they had been there. And she went there and it was all overgrown. It was all like covered in weeds and there was algae growing in the pools and nobody had been working there, so it just grew over. And she had to make the decision whether or not to keep it, right? Whether it was worth it for the Hearst Corporation to keep the Hearst Castle. And they had offered it to a bunch of people. Everybody had said no. And finally, she said, let's offer it to the state of California. And they did, and the state of California took it. And the rest is history, as they say. Yes.
Yeah, no, there's so many things that this is why people need to read the book. There's so much we can go into, so many stories after Hearst, and everything to do with the corporation is fascinating. I want to go a little bit broader now. How has writing this book and conducting the research for it, how has that changed your perspective on the history of California?
I'm a native Californian, so I was born and raised here. So I feel like I've always known these names. Like I've always known like Morgan and Hearst and these names are synonymous with California to a certain extent. But reading the Kevin Starr books, the Kevin Starr books are amazing. And getting the lay of the land of California in all these different decades, it's changed my sort of the way that I interact with even different landmarks, like when I go around Oakland and say, oh, is Julia Morgan built that? Julia Morgan built that, or designed that, I should say. And then when I'm in LA, oh, Marion was there at this time, and Hearst was there at that time. So I can link people to places in a way that I was not really able to before. Yeah, so 10 years, 9, 10 years writing a book, we'll do that to you.
Absolutely. All right. We always close these podcasts with book recommendations. They can be about our subject matter or just things that would interest those that are interested in California and history. Do you have some books you'd like to recommend?
If you are interested in early Hollywood, I would recommend this book called Without Lying Down, Frances Marion and the Powerful Women of Early Hollywood. by Carrie Beacham, who was a mentor of mine. And we sadly lost her almost 2 years ago now, or a year and a half ago. And it was a huge loss, and she's greatly missed. But that this book is the ultimate book about early Hollywood. Yes, get that one for sure. And there, if you want to read about Marion, there's unfortunately not a whole lot about it. There's mine and there's Giles. So you can read mine.
Do you think there's value in picking up Giles at this point, or does it feel a bit dated? I feel like yours is updated with the what can we gain from Giles by going back and reading at this point? Is there something to be gained there?
I think that he, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if, I think the reason to read Giles would be to compare what he, to cross-reference, right?
Honestly.
R2, yeah.
Yeah, maybe this
That's
actually, Laura, this is probably a bad question. I'm asking
the
you, like, why is your book better than Kyle's? Or, like, why
first.
is this book even relevant? Or, I'm just going to cut that whole question out.
Okay.
Anyway, do you have one of the early books or the books that I read that I loved about Hollywood history was City of Nets? It's a fascinating story about immigrant exiles coming to Hollywood, and it takes place in the early
Oh,
days.
okay.
Super fascinating. But yeah, I love the history of Hollywood, I think, is so fascinating. And honestly, I don't know if you feel this way. Honestly, I feel like the surface has barely been scratched. I think there's just so many stories. Hollywood creates its own mythology, but some great narrative nonfiction about those early days I would absolutely love. So.
Yeah. And there's a lot. Actually, we could talk about Carrie Beacham's books all day long. But yeah, Without Lying Down. And then she wrote another book called My First Time in Hollywood, which is a compilation of essays from various people recounting their first times seeing Hollywood.
Okay.
Very cool.
All right. Last question. I've got two more. What if no one, if a listener has not seen a single Marion Davis movie, where should they start?
I would say Show People.
Show people. Okay.
Start
Why?
with Show People. It's a tight, good movie that has aged impeccably well. It's a lot of fun. I've known people who have never seen a black and white movie before who watch Show People and say that was amazing. So it's just a fantastic movie. So you should definitely watch that. And then after you watch Show People, Blondie of the Follies is actually pretty good. I really enjoy Blondie of the Follies. And what else is,
And there's so many good ones.
yeah.
Yeah, I could go on and on. And if you're struggling a little bit, just go watch The General, go watch The Navigator, go watch Steam, just go watch a Buster Keaton. He'll get you in the zone. I feel like Marion Davis
No.
carries the screen, but if you're struggling, like Chaplin, go watch City Lights. There's so many great options.
Yeah, but Marion Davies is great. Like
Yeah,
she's just,
absolutely.
yeah,
Absolutely.
like she, if he, it, definitely Show People. Definitely Show People. That's a really good entryway film.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Perfect.
And
What are you working on next?
I'm starting research on a new project, but it hasn't gotten very far yet. I still have to go to New York and do some research.
Got it. Is it film related?
It's film related, yeah.
Okay.
So I'm testing the waters in this new thing.
I really enjoyed your book. I love this
Thank you.
particular period of Hollywood history. And I think that someone like Marion Davies, who was generally, and I agree with you, generally, just a very kind person
Yeah.
that was swimming in waters with people that are, to call them sharks would be an understatement. And to carry on that character and disposition throughout her life makes her a worthwhile person to read about. So, again, your book is called Captain of Her Soul, The Life of Marion Davies. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.